All right, testing, testing. So, Friday, it was day two. We had arrived Wednesday night and basically just went from the airport to the hotel Wednesday. And you've already seen Thursday's pictures of being at Eshkelon and at Gath. Also, Eila, the Valley of Eila, where David fought Goliath. That was pretty much the tour of the first day. And so on Friday, we got up early, of course, and we left Eshkelon on the Mediterranean Sea and headed south to the Red Sea. And notice how lush and green this area is. It is the wet season, so it would be a little bit greener than normal, but it is also the lower half of the Plain of Sharon, the wettest and most fertile area in all Israel. Here's a metal map of Israel I found at Beth Shean on day four. So you can see the Dead Sea encircled by white lines there, kind of in the dead center of the map. It's a little bit hard to see, but anyway. The Plain of Sharon is in the blue box, approximately. It lies on Israel's Mediterranean coast and extends from the Mediterranean Sea eastward to the foothills of the Samaria-Judean Mountains, and from the southern foot of Mount Carmel in the north to about Gaza in the south. And here this shows our general direction of travel on day two. Our day's itinerary included going to Stay Boker, or if I could try to pronounce it the way they do it, Stay Boker. And it's view, and at that spot we were going to see the view of the wilderness of Zin, at an overlook there. Then we were going to stop at the canyon of Ein Avdat, drive through the Ramon crater, and then tour the tabernacle, the reconstruction of the tabernacle at Timnah near Solomon's Pillars. That's down in the Paran wilderness. And then later we were going to have a driving tour of the city of Eilat and the Red Sea area, the southernmost point of Israel. And so that blue line shows pretty much the direction of travel we went down that day on the road system. The main green highway signs are written in Hebrew, Arabic, and English. And that's kind of nice for us English-speaking folks. But then there's a lot of other signs that are not nearly so helpful, unless, of course, you just want gas or food. You can figure that one out. Or there's a right-hand arrow. If you want to go to the right just because you feel good about it, it's time to change course. Not very helpful. So there's a lot of signs that I was wondering, I wonder what that says, and I wonder where we're going. But the green signs kind of helped me out quite a bit. The vegetation there quickly changed as we neared Beersheba. Let me go back to the map of Israel. So that little, let me get my pointer. Eshkelon is where we started, and then this little roundabout, that's where the city of Beersheba is. Okay? And so we went around the actual city of Beersheba. There's roads that bypass it, so we didn't have to get into a bunch of traffic. So that's right where Beersheba is. You notice we didn't go very far, somewhere about 50 miles or so, or less, through the lush green area. And by the time we got to Beersheba, the vegetation had quickly changed. The city is at the northern end of the Negev Desert, and the countryside had dried out considerably in that distance. Beersheba, you can see it in the far distance. That's as close to Beersheba as we got. Sorry about the picture, but anyway. Beersheba is the third largest city in Israel. Jerusalem is the biggest, then Tel Aviv. And Beersheba is the capital of the southern district of the Negev. Beersheba was named Well of the Seven Oath by Abraham at his covenant with Abimelech. What else happened here? Abraham and Isaac spent a lot of time right here. Abraham sent Hagar away from this point when he sent Ishmael and Hagar into exile. Abraham planted a grove there and called on the name of the Lord, the Bible tells us. Abraham traveled from there to Moriah to offer Isaac as a sacrifice to the Lord. God appeared to Isaac here in Beersheba. Jacob left Beersheba on his journey to Haran. Jacob stopped in Beersheba on his way to Egypt and offered sacrifices to God here. Also, this area, this city, was allotted to the tribe of Simeon in the middle of Judah's allotment, and Elijah left his servant here when he went a day's journey into the wilderness. So these are all biblical events that happened in this area. Just south of Beersheba, we drove through past a nomad village. Due to uncontrollable smuggling, which the nomads are the kings of smuggling, apparently, the Israeli government has planted their nomads. You know, usually they're in tents and they move around a lot. Well, Israel couldn't let them be doing that, so they have planted them in these cities, in these makeshift towns. And they're not poor. The nomads are not poor. If they wanted to, they could build nice houses. But the nomad culture is such that, you know, you don't build things. You don't have structures. How a nomad shows his wealth is the jewelry hanging off of his wife or wives. And so their culture they're not building people. And so they just have these makeshift structures. Maybe in the future their ideas will change. But for now, it's still tent-like is their ideas. Immediately south of Beersheba, we officially entered the Negev Desert. This desert includes both the wildernesses of Zin and Paran. Zin, on a modern map, is in the north, close to Beersheba. And then Paran is in the south, and I'm not sure where the breakoff point is or where the one starts and the other ends, but the Negev Desert includes both of those wildernesses that are mentioned in the Bible. Of course, they would overlap into Egypt as well in the Sinai, by the way. But within the Negev, Israel has built hundreds, literally hundreds, of man-made oases, plural of oasis. They are built in low spots and are designed with earthen berms. You can see that right there is an earthen berm that goes around it. So these earthen berms channel or funnel all the water, all the rainwater, to the center to keep those trees alive. And so they built all these as places that people can stop and rest, or the nomads could use. But the idea is to start to retake the desert, to de-desertification the desert. But anyway, so that's the beginning of the de-desertification of the northern part of the Negev. The northern Negev is primarily sandy, at least where we drove through. But the further south one goes, the more the rocks become mixed in, and it gets very, very, very rocky. Like we said on the itinerary, our first stop was at the kibbutz, Sde Boker, the former home and burial place of the Ben-Gurions, Israel's first prime minister and his wife. This wasn't their home. This is just a memorial building built for them, by the way. His home is in a different area of this kibbutz. Because of drip irrigation, which is Israel's own invention, Israel can build beautiful gardens in the middle of the desert. This particular garden path at Sde Boker was designed to look like a dry riverbed. They did a good job. David Ben-Gurion loved the Negev. The original British land grant proposed in 1947 allotted the entire Negev to the Palestinians because there were no Jews living there. It was entirely due to Ben-Gurion's plan, which, if I can remember, it was called the 11 Points Plan, if you want to look it up, the 11 Points Plan. It was entirely due to Ben-Gurion's plan and effort of getting Jewish settlers into the Negev within the next year that Britain acknowledged their presence and ceded the Negev to Israel. So he got 11 kibbutzes planted in the Negev in the next 12 months, approximately. And he did that. They did that. At each kibbutz, there was nothing one day, and the next day, there was a kibbutz established. They brought all the buildings in prefabricated. The first thing they had to do was build a wall, a bulletproof wall, to protect themselves from the Palestinians. And they built a wall, then a watchtower, and then two buildings and a water system, I believe is the primary what they did there in one day. to establish 11 kibbutzes in the Negev. Today, the Negev comprises about 50% of the entire landmass of Israel, including the Palestinian lands of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. Without this desert, Israel would have no southern seaport at Eilat, and Eilat is their only seaport that bypasses the Suez Canal toward the eastern lands. It was very near this area. This is the wilderness of Zin, from which Moses sent the 12 spies from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land of Canaan. So this is what the wilderness of Zin looks like, what they were traveling through and wandering in for 40 years. Here's a short video clip. So I'm going to pause it right there. We're going to be on the other end of that canyon in just a few hours. And in that canyon there is a spring which flows out into this area. And so it's entirely possible that we're looking at a campsite of the Israelites right now. Water is very scarce in the desert, so it would make sense that this could have been one of the stops. And this, of course, is at Stay Boker, where the Ben-Gurions are buried right there. That's their, not gravesite, whatever the above-ground things are called. No, I'm sorry. According to our guide, they are buried beneath the surface. They just build those things on top of the graves. This picture, like I said, shows the outlet or the beginning of the Ian Avdat Canyon. We were about to go view, but from the other end of it. And until you are right on top of it, you don't realize there's a huge canyon in front of you. There at the parking spot of the Ian Avdat Canyon. There it is. It's a great big canyon there with a spring down at the bottom. Beautiful place. And there's me. I was there. Like I said, since there's a spring here, it's entirely possible that the Israelites camped in the open valley floor beneath Stay Boker. Water is hard to find. And here's some steps that they carved out of the rock. Israel uses what they have when they can in their national parks. They aren't all fancy and necessarily bring in all the equipment to build new stuff. They just use what was here from old times many times. For the intrepid tourist with time on their hands, one can hike up this canyon from the bottom to the top, but you're not allowed to go down. It's a one-way road for some reason. I was told there's some ladders, straight-up ladder, vertical ladders halfway down or halfway through the climb, and so they don't want people going down those ladders. They only want them going up the ladders. But anyway, in the distance on the far plateau, let me get my pointer, way over here, is Stay Boker, where we used to be. It sits there in that greenery. So that's where we came from. Then our next stop, which wasn't a stop at all, we were just driving through it, was the Ramon Crater, the largest natural erosion crater on the surface of the earth. And you can see the edges of it there, how it goes all the way around. Somewhere over in this general vicinity is where the water poured out of this crater. And it's a great big crater. All formed from water during Noah's flood, rushing off the landscape. And the black spots are what's left over from where lava seeped up through the surface of the ground. And so it's lava rock spots in places. There's a big black spot out there. But it's the largest erosion crater on the earth. And there's our group. Very comfortable bus. There used to be some sound, but I guess we forgot to get that set up. I'm sorry. We'll try for that next time on the next PowerPoint. There's that black spot again. But this is the area that the children of Israel wandered through for 40 years. At the other end of this erosion crater, the road drops down through this the water runoff area down to the coastal plain, the bottom of the Great Rift Valley, which runs from the Middle East, all of the Jordan River Valley, all the way from Mount Hermon in the north and beyond it. The Great Rift Valley goes south all the way into Africa, the largest valley on earth, I believe it is. Then at the bottom, back at the sea level, this is sea level. The plain, this is the plain that goes north toward the Dead Sea, along the border with Jordan. Those mountains in the distance are Jordanian, and this valley would drop down to 1,390 feet below sea level at the Salt Sea, the Dead Sea. There is a mountain range along each side of this deep valley, all the way from beyond Galilee in the north. Galilee itself is also 700 feet below sea level. The entire Jordan River, from Galilee on at least, is below sea level. So you can see this steady mountain range all the way. I didn't realize there was mountains, so steep mountains all the way, especially on the Jordanian side. I thought there were some flat spots going into Jordan, but there is no flat spots. Again, this is a land of Israel's wanderings. 40 years of being in such a place. Then our next stop, we entered this canyon leading to Solomon's copper mines. Solomon owned these mines at one point. Egypt owned these mines. Probably Babylon owned the mines. Who knows who else controlled these mines in ancient history. But these mines were mined for centuries, if not for thousands of years. And as we entered this canyon and headed toward them, the thought struck me, I wonder how many millions of slaves marched up this valley on their way to the mines, basically to their deaths. This used to be a view of total misery. Anybody condemned to the mines never went home. And in the distance, there they are, the copper mines of Timna, somewhere in all those pillars of rock. And those pillars are called Solomon's Pillars. Solomon's Pillars mark the location of his mines. They are a natural rock formation created by erosion of the rock by water. And the actual Solomon's Pillars are, I couldn't figure out, they didn't tell me which spot was Solomon's Pillars until I saw my own pictures later. I figured out what the actual pillars were. We'll see a better view of them. This is one pillar, another pillar, and then this is a third pillar over here. So I didn't get a very good picture of them from this angle. And they don't look like pillars very much from this angle, but this video clip will show them better. This begins looking toward an oasis over here where the reconstructed tabernacle is set up. It's a fun place for people to go. There's a man-made pool and things to do right there. But this video begins and then pans towards Solomon's pillars. So there they are. That's a better view of the three of Solomon's pillars. So that's why they decided to name that rock formation something fancy. And this is that video that I tried to show the other day on Wednesday night when we were talking about the tabernacle. I finally got it to go. So we found the tabernacle in the middle of the desert. Moses left it there for us to find, I guess. No, not really. This is a reconstruction by a Southern Baptist group, I believe it is. Southern Baptists own this and have set it up to be a testimony there to Israel. And this lady that's behind the altar is a volunteer, and she gave us a detailed tour talking about Jesus Christ and how the tabernacle points to what Jesus did on the cross. And so there, it's a great, great testimony to any Israelites who want to come and see this place and have a tour especially. And then, as you can see, it's a pretty big area. I'm going to stop it right there because it just is me panning the camera back and forth from then on. But I took these videos so the kids understand how big the tabernacle courtyard was. This is set up to size. And so a lot of Israelite men could fit inside this enclosure. And this is from the back. From the outside, the tabernacle doesn't look like much. It looks pretty boring and plain. And it's a picture of Jesus to somebody who is lost and does not believe Jesus is the Messiah. To them, Jesus looks pretty plain. What's so special about Jesus Christ? That's what this tabernacle, the drab outside of it, points to. And this is another video. The brazen altar, where all the sacrifices were made. Somebody walked in front of me right there. So that's the brass laver, the washing stand. And then the tabernacle itself, of course. So a big area. And it's neat that they put it at the base of this mountain. It kind of looks like Mount Sinai. Here's a video of the main room inside the tabernacle with the table of showbread. There I am, and there's the remade menorah, 7-branch candlestick. So here's some closer-up pictures of all the 7 pieces of furniture. Not 7, 6 pieces of furniture. The brazen altar for the sacrifices. The brass laver for washing and cleansing. The menorah. The 7-branched solid gold candlestick. Of course, that one's not solid gold. The golden table of showbread. And that's a pretty accurate portrayal of the showbread. They probably did stack it in 2 stacks of 6 loaves of bread. And then we have this good reconstruction of the robes of the high priest. You see the ephod. When you read about an ephod in the Bible, it's referring to the high priest's breastplate. So that's the breastplate with the 12 fancy stones with the names of the 12 tribes written on written on each stone, 1 tribe per stone. And the names of the 12 tribes are also written on the shoulder pieces of the high priest there. And then when you read about the golden mitre in the Bible, that's simply talking about the golden crown on his head, on the head of the high priest, part of his robes. There's the golden altar of incense. There are the coals from off the brazen altar were brought in and used to burn the sacred mixture of frankincense before the Lord. The cherub-covered veil that hid the Holy of Holies. We don't know exactly how these things looked, but these are pretty good illustrations to us. And within the Holy of Holies stood the Ark of the Covenant of the God of all the earth. And inside that ark lay the law, or what we call the Ten Commandments, which would also include all of the 5 books of Moses, and also the golden pot of manna and Aaron's rod that budded. These were the three objects inside the Ark of the Covenant. All of this pictured the Lord Jesus Christ and his coming atonement for sin by the shedding of his blood on the cross. There are many, many people outside of Jesus Christ who do not see or understand his beauty or what he did for them. To them, he is just a man. That's what this tabernacle pictures. But to those who believe in him, he is the God-man who shed his blood and died as a sacrifice for all our sin. He is our cleansing. He is the light of life. He is the bread of life. He is our great high priest. He is the door through which every man must enter. He is the one who is cut off but came alive again. He is where the justice of God met the mercy of God, which covered over the entire terrible price demanded by the law of God. He indeed is our resurrection and life. Indeed, yea, he is all in all, the Lord Jesus Christ. This is what the tabernacle should show us and remind us of. Then after leaving that area, we went down all the rest of the way down and saw the Red Sea. We saw Eilat. There is a part of Eilat in the closer buildings. And then in the far distance, which you can't see the buildings very good, but on that far mountain side, down low, down by the water, is another city, the Jordanian city of Aqaba. And we also saw parts of Egypt. You're looking at Jordan. And in a minute, we'll show you a piece of Saudi Arabia. And we also, of course, saw more of Israel. And this is, I apologize for not being able to show you a better picture of Eilat. There was just no good vantage point. We were either in places like this, or we were down in the middle of buildings where all I could show was a picture of one building. But Eilat is this city right on the other side of this hillside. And then there's a break, which you can't really see on the screen, but you can see it better on my pictures. There's a break between the two cities, and then this city over here in the distance is Aqaba. And there's the Jordanian flag flying in the distance over Aqaba. That's a big flag. Must be a good 100 feet long. There's some Eilat hotels there, again with Aqaba in the distance, and the Red Sea. Down the coast on the western side of the Red Sea, Israel owns just a little tiny stretch of that area. And you can see Saudi Arabia hills there. Jordan doesn't own very much down either. Saudi Arabia and Egypt own most of that, of the sides there of the Red Sea. And you can't see it very good on your screen, but there is a Saudi Arabian port right here. So you're looking at Saudi Arabia right there. Many people may disagree with me, and that's fine. But I believe this is the fork of the Red Sea that was parted for Israel to cross on dry ground. And somewhere beyond those hills is the biblical Mount Sinai, which the Bible says is in Arabia in Galatians. Then we went all the way to the Egyptian border. Beyond those gates, you're looking at Egypt. And then we went up in the hills to the west of Eilat, and in those hills, lying along the border with Egypt, were dozens of reminders that Egypt is not Israel's friend. Dozens and dozens of bunkers. Machine gun bunkers. Nor can Israel trust them, trust Egypt, because Egypt has invaded Israel in four different wars in the last 75 years. Then we finally arrived at our hotel that evening, for which your group can be really grateful sometimes, especially if your people have not gone lately. Our guide taught us that the most important rule for every guide was also found in the Bible: let my people go. Most important rule for the guide. All right. Well, thank you. We'll take about a 15-minute break and then come back at noon for the second service. You're dismissed.